In my clinical practice, I often see people who are high in openness because they're attracted to me because they watch my lectures, and you have to kind of be high in openness to like my lectures. So because, well, you do, because they go everywhere, you know, and they're not necessarily very orderly. So anyways, lots of my clients are really high in openness, and they're funny people often, especially if they're smart, because sometimes they have the most nihilistic intelligence you can imagine. It's just self-critical and nihilistic and brutal, man, and smart. And so they just criticize themselves out of existence. And so often I have to just try to get them to quit listening to their chattering self-critical rationality and go out and create something, you know, with their massive creativity. And as long as they're doing that, they're engaged in the world and happy as hell. But as soon as that self-critical rationality comes in and shuts down the creativity, they're just like walking corpses, you know. And it's because if you're really open, like you're a tree and it has some trunks, and you know, your most prominent trait is the most lively trunk. And if you're a creative person and you're not engaging in a creative enterprise, you're like a tree that has had its vitality amputated. And so this is not trivial. This is deeply, deeply, deeply rooted in your biology. And those are people often who have like dream lives you just can't believe. I have one client, he has like four spectacular dreams a week, and most of the time we just spend discussing them. I mean, God. And I had another client who could be lucid in her dreams, which is more common among women. She could ask the damn characters what they represented and they would tell her. It was like, okay, that was pretty weird. And like a lot of the things they told her were really helpful, and they were not things that she wanted to hear. She basically, one of them told her if she was going to live, she'd have to go visit a slaughterhouse. And the reason for that was because she was raised as a little princess and protected from horrible Mother Nature until she hit puberty, in which time she turned into an evil villain, because that's how the family worked. Perfect child, evil teenager, overnight. And then, well, that was hard on her, and she wasn't prepared because she thought the world was princess world, and, you know, she couldn't go through a butcher store without having a fit. And no wonder, you know, like really, Jesus, you know, it's no wonder, but you do it. But she couldn't, so we used to go to butcher stores, and that would make her cry, and that she was a vegetarian, that would make her cry, and, you know, bemoan the cruelty of the world. And it's like, yeah, fair enough, man, those are bloody slabs of meat. It's like, I don't know why everyone isn't screaming when they walk through the butcher store, but you gotta get used to it, man, because you can't live in the world otherwise. And so the dream character, who was a gypsy, told her that she had to go visit a slaughterhouse, which seemed rather impractical. And so I asked her if she could think of anything else to do, and she thought, well, why don't we go visit a funeral home and watch an embalming? And I thought, oh, good, that sounds like a fun way to spend a day. And so I phoned up a funeral parlor, and I said I had a client who was terrified of death. Yeah, and I was a therapist who was also a little shaky on the concept myself. And so they had no problem with that. They deal with death all the time, which is really something to think about, right? A human being can actually have an occupation where they do nothing but deal with death, and they don't go stark raving mad. It's like, what the hell's up with that? It's like working in a palliative care ward where your clients that you know have a relationship, all they're going to do is die this week, next week, the week after. People do that. It's like, those people are tough, man. They're tough. So anyways, we went and watched this embalming, which was, I have a rather high level of disgust sensitivity, so it was a little on the rough side for me. But she sat there, and first of all, we were outside this little room, she was not looking at that, man, no way. Then she'd kind of go like this, and you know, that was pretty good. And then she'd go like this, and then she'd go like this, and then she watched it. And then she asked if she could go in, and she put on a glove and she touched the body, and she didn't have a fit, she didn't have a panic attack, and so she walked away from there learning that there was a hell of a lot more to her than she thought there was, and that she could see things that she didn't think she could see and live. And after that she sort of had a touchstone. It's like, well, I'm kind of afraid of this. Well, is it as bad as going to see the embalming? No, it's not that bad. Well, I guess I can do it. It's like an initiation, right? She had an initiation, and so did I, you know. And I learned a lot from doing that. I learned that one of the things you need to do if you're going to be a human being is to prepare yourself to be useful in the face of death. And so when you have a parent that dies, which, you know, shatters people's ideas, often they can't even think about it. If you can't even think about that, man, you've got some thinking to do. Because you need to be able to at least think about that, because otherwise you're just going to be a wasteland when it happens. And you never know, you could even have a higher ambition. Maybe you could even be useful when it happens, instead of being part of the heap of destroyed people who also have to be taken care of. You know, and that's brutal. You have to be brutal to be useful in the aftermath of your parents' death. You know, you don't get to crumble and fall apart, and no, you have every reason to. So you got to be kind of some tough monster to manage that. But do you want to be useful in the face of tragedy, or do you want to be pathetic? Well, you make your choice.